especially west of North Belfast, there's really high rates of male suicide. So I thought for ages, all you were reading about was such and such has committed suicide and this, that and the other, and it was constant. It was just felt like if I could put it out there and someone could relate to someone playing sport or someone just a normal sort of guy going about working, playing, whatever, doing normal things, that, you know, it's all right. It's okay not to be feeling okay, that you can go and do something about it, you know, and get help.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast. I am your host, Shane Breslin. If this is your first time here, welcome. The Life Well Lived podcast is a series of conversations with people from all walks of life on navigating life's challenges, becoming our best selves in the world, whatever that might be, in all our own amazing individuality, and ultimately on living a life well lived, because I fully believe these two things. I believe that number one, happiness is the point of existence, and number two, that happiness is to be found in doing and being rather than having. This week's guest first properly came to my attention and to the attention of many people around Ireland about a year ago. Chris Kerr is a goalkeeper with the Antrim Gaelic football team. A quick word for any non-Irish or non-sporty listeners. We mentioned some acronyms in this interview. The GAA is the Gaelic Athletic Association, the governing body for the native games of Gaelic football and hurling in Ireland. And the GPA is the Gaelic Players Association, a representative body for the country's top players, of which Chris is a member. A year ago, Chris Kerr wrote an honest, revealing and heartfelt piece about his own experiences with depression and anxiety following the illness and death of his father 5 years previously. That depression and anxiety brought him to the brink when out for a night with friends from his football club. He contemplated the River Laggan and the end of his own life. In this conversation, we talk about his lowest point and how he came back from there, and why he decided to write about his experiences, and how Belfast in Northern Ireland is the place where young men are most at risk in Europe. He also chats about the stigma of mental health, the positives of social media, and how he's reminded of his late father every time he takes to the field at his St. Gall's club in West Belfast. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, I would be very, very grateful if you could do two things. And number one, share it with someone who might like it too. And number two, subscribe to the Life Well Lived podcast in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, so you never miss an episode each week. Thank you for listening, and now on with the show with Antrim Gaelic footballer and mental health advocate Chris Kerr. And we started by talking about Chris's lowest point, and we also mentioned an article by another Gaelic footballer in Ireland called Alan O'Mara, whose own article about his struggles with depression Chris came upon at a very, very opportune time.
People would think you're being nearly shouting dramatic, where you're going, I can't remember much more of that match, you know. And I would have a pretty good memory of remembering a lot of detail in games, like, and I literally remember about two or three things in that match, and in hindsight, even look at photos of myself during that game, I was like, what was I doing? What was I thinking there? But I threw myself back into playing and training and even working. And then it was probably about 6 months later we could beat the championship. And then, as you do, you go out and sort of went out the night of the match. It was at home. And then a few of us went out again on the Monday, which was, that's when it all started coming to a head, I think, because for ages I was like, nah, I'm grand, I'll throw myself back in it, I'll be fine. And then I remember going out on that Monday and just going, we went to a bar, it's in Belfast called Cutter's Wharf, it's along the River Laggan, and I remember just sitting there going, I'd love to just jump in there. That was all I kept thinking. Everyone was having a crack, it was five or six of us having a crack, and I just kept thinking, going, I'd love to just jump in here, like, and I was like, the hell's wrong with me? And then I remember going to the toilet and like nearly uncontrollably sobbing. And then I led on to them, and then I went to the toilet, and I just got a taxi home. That was the next day. I read Alan's piece, and I was like, "It's very, very similar." And
so did you seek out Alan's piece,
or no,
did you come across it?
I came across it on Twitter. So that's all I'd done was, you were nearly lying in bed, just scrolling on social media, like looking for something to help you, or I don't know. It was nearly like an addiction then, just scrolling on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, just, and then I came across Alan's, I came across it because I'm Antrim's GPA rep, so I knew all about the, I followed the GPA page, and then that's how it was on it. And then they rang the confidential line the next that day, and then within 24 hours was speaking to a counsellor, and then arranged to go and meet him. I think the first time I went, it was like July, and the weather was the way it had been there, you know, one of 20 odd degrees, really warm. Met him at a place, Clonard Monastery, it's a big church there in West Belfast. I remember just like sweating, taking real, was like fighting myself to get out of the car. And then when I did go in, it was like he had a bit of a football background, like, and then just literally spoke about, for the first time, about 55 minutes, just about football. And then the last 5 minutes or so, I just threw in, oh, I'm not feeling great about my dad, and ran out. That was the first one. And then, like, but even just that 5 minutes of saying something, I was like, felt like I'd lost 2 stone getting back in the car. I was like, because I wasn't talking to friends or mum, and I've mum and one, I was going to say I've one mum and one sister, I've only one mum, so I wasn't speaking to them, and I was trying to put on a front for them because there was only sort of boy in the house then. So I went to the counselling for about a year or so, and felt like it just was sort of hit a plateau with it, like it was just sort of going, and didn't really, like, it did help initially, I think, getting but it wasn't going to fix it, sort of thing. I tried medication, didn't agree with me at all. Actually made me worse, like lack of sleep and mad dreams. And then you were going into work, the cycle was nearly, I was coming home, laying in bed, not sleeping, going to sleep at about 5 a.m, getting up at 7, going to work. It was just a vicious circle. And then with the medication too, like, that is one of the symptoms, is that it can make you worse. So it just didn't agree with me at all, and it was making me worse. So I was like, I wanna do it without medication. And I suppose the best drug available is exercise. And that, like, going and playing Gaelic and training and going to a gym or whatever, like, found after a while doing that. And I went to CBT, went to that twice. I felt it was a big turning point, you know, that changing the way you think, and that it's all right to have bad days, and, you know, it's not the end of the world if something, you know. I heard someone saying, like, you know, if you hear people going, I had a bad day today, well, what happened? You know, I had this guy in work, was a nightmare for an hour. But, like, that's 1 hour out of 24, do you know? So the 23 other hours, 8 of them you were sleeping. You know, so it wasn't a bad day, it was a bad hour. I think rationalising, thinking, and I suppose just letting, I end up telling a few people, like, good, very good friends of mine's in the round, who would have known then, do you know, that, like, asking you to go on nights out, no, and you're always coming up with an excuse, nah, I can't be bothered, and skint and all this here stuff, just to avoid it, because, like, I was always, like, and I'm now, even still, but during that time, like I'd always have been in the middle of the messing and joking and loudest in the change room, like any goalkeeper probably, like, there's something wrong with goalkeepers, like, in general. So I think when other people started going, what's wrong with you, you're quiet, and all, and then I was like, God, is it really obvious? And then, so you become an expert then of putting a mask on and saying, ah, yeah, sure. When somebody asks you, how are you? Grand. They don't really listen to the next answer. It's just like, how are you? You know, it's like...
Going back to your dad's illness and death, which you wrote about amazingly well on the GPA website. When you wrote about it... In the week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that, it got a lot of attention. There was a lot of people getting in touch with you. How do you kind of reflect on it now?
It's crazy. At the time, I was sort of, I suppose I'd thought about it for a long, I'd thought about doing it for a long time, in particular because in West Belfast, where I'm from, and play all my Gaelic football, and There's big issues with mental health. I don't know if it's linked to, you know, the past in those areas, especially west and north Belfast. There's really high rates of male suicide. So I thought for ages, nearly getting this day, it's not that all you were reading about was such and such has done, like, committed suicide and this, that and the other, and it was constant. I just felt like if I could put it out there and someone could relate to someone playing sport or someone just a normal sort of guy going about working, playing, whatever, doing normal things, that, you know, it's all right. It's okay not to be feeling okay, that you can go and do something about it, you know, and get help. So the initial reaction was crazy. I didn't think it was going to go as far as it would have, but it just shows you how many people have either been affected by it or know someone. And even the amount of, it was more the amount of, like, thinking that you're taken back more by people that you don't know contacting you, you know, not that you sort of, I have a lot of really close friends, like, you know, borderline near, feel like they're brothers and related, like, you know, so you sort of half expect them to get in touch, but I think it's when it sort of reaches people so far away, you know, all over the country, all over, like, there was people in England, Scotland, and different places were getting in touch. So I think when it goes that far, you're like, right, you know, just shows you how prevalent it is. And, you know, we're very quick to speak about, you know, my dad had cancer, very quick to speak about people that have cancer. And, yep, you know, if you get injured playing football or Gaelic or whatever, you go to A&E and, you know, you get put in a cast, you get help there. But, you know, it seems like Irish males in general are, you know, a bit iffy about speaking about mental health. Mm. And if you're not looking after your brain, then, you know, I mean, if you're not looking after it, then what hope have you got?
When you're talking about there, you mentioned cancer, and the cancer has a name, and injuries have a name. Mm-hmm. What do you call? Do you have a name for what you were going through or went through, or what do you call it, or when you're talking about it?
I just call it what it is. It's like, you know, I just think that just depression and anxiety. I suppose I probably nearly, it was the anxiety more for me. You know, I would say I'm in a good place of managing the depression side of things. Anxiety's just an ongoing thing. Like, it's like anyone, you hear people go, God, I'm feeling, you know, that would give you anxiety, and then you're going, when I had it, it was like, still, obviously, I think, you know, I don't think it's really anything that would ever leave you.
How does it manifest itself? So on the anxiety side of things, how does that manifest itself?
Especially at that time where it was like, you know, things weren't rational, and I wasn't thinking things through. Like, you know, if something bad happened in the temporary job I was in, it escalated, and you're like, start thinking about all the negative things. And I guess this days were like, I think it mentioned in it, where it was probably like about a 3-month block of where it was really bad, where like couldn't get out of bed, always ringing in sick, the agency jobs, and lost. Like, and this was during playing National League and coming up the Championship. Probably could do with doing it now, but I lost near, you know, a stone and a half, 2 stone of, like, not eating. And, you know, all girlfriend and mum would vouch for it. Like, all I do is, if I'm not eating, they'd be asking why, like, you know, not, like, in general. Where then it was just, like, just couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. And then it was just a vicious circle. And then it's only when you start realizing, like, I'm quite thin anyway, like, but clothes start swinging off, you're like, right, what's going on, like, so, yeah, it's a tough one, like, you know, it's an invisible sort of, I won't say disease, but.
Do you think of it as a disease or an illness, or, because I'm in two minds, like, I hear different people talking about it in different ways, but I find myself disagreeing with people that describe it as an illness, because I'm not sure that it is, but that's just my.
No, it's a hard one to describe. It's even a hard one to describe how it happens. You know, I don't think it's a disease where, you know, anyone that is anxious or has anxiety should walk about with a bell on them, you know, to keep people away. I think it's like, it's being able to manage it and putting things in place to make sure it doesn't manifest into something major. And, you know, as we're touching on suicide rates, you know, that seems to be the trend. You know, something small happens and then it snowball effects, and then it escalates to where someone feels if no other way out. And I think depression and anxiety go hand in hand too, you know, the sort of, you know, they're, when one's at the peak, the other one's right beside it, and it's like a double-edged sword going at people, I think. So.
And my own experience was, and come back to the kind of illness side of things, like when you have an illness, it's very, generally most illnesses are treatable by mm-hmm. by medication or drugs, yeah. and you can get, and reliably treatable.
Mm-hmm.
And that just doesn't seem to be good. Yeah, yes, a lot of people have said to me about kind of, you know, that drugs, medication was very effective for them, but there's mm-hmm. loads of other people have said that it's completely the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
And have been so, and I think when you think about it as a disease or an illness, mm-hmm. It almost kind of justifies the kind of, well, like, it's nothing to do with me, so like I just can go down the medication route and I can kind of keep it at arm's length,
yeah.
like that. I can kind of maybe even abdicate a little bit of responsibility in times like, oh, it's nothing to do with me, I just kind of treatable by drugs,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of like when it comes to the medication side of things, was that something that was recommended for you kind of early, or did you opt to go down that route?
I suppose I was sort of looking into it myself, and then when I went to the doctor, initially they were sort of, you know, reluctant at the start, because probably my age, it was probably 26, 27. You know, they were reluctant, and because of my, normally how much I was training and stuff, I think it was during the stage as well where I felt like the training and the games were a chore, where you felt like it was like a real fight to go to training, and then, you know, getting picked up by a car share with your mates going to training, or, you know, I used to travel with two very good friends the Antrim training every night, and the struggle when they see me get in the car, that was like, you know, it was just normal me, but like the fighting and the ordeal of putting socks on, and, you know, it was like, and that's what it felt like an ordeal, you know, every night going to training. It was like you were mentally drained before you even went, and then just concentration levels were all over the place. I don't know how I played, actually, in hindsight.
Yeah,
like, but
When the game started, because I used to, at different times. When I was kind of that two or three years, yeah. when I was really bad, I was a club Gaelic football, Gaelic goalkeeper for 15 years, but I hated looking for, like, the hour before training was yeah. almost the worst hour of the week before
yeah.
training,
yeah.
and like, you know, after training was okay because yeah. like having got through it. Games themselves were mm-hmm. like, you know, like almost that was, I didn't meditate, or I don't meditate, mm-hmm. I'm very bad at kind of that type of thing, but that felt like the game itself felt like a meditation in terms yeah. of just being in the zone.
Yeah.
What were your kind of, was that similar for you?
Yeah, or? I think it was, yeah, it's like, you know, the training and stuff, and I think sort of nearly like when you were playing club league games and stuff, where you were like, this feels like a chore, but then when it went to like club championship games, and where it was sort of, you know, it's knockout, then it's do or die. Then it was different. Like, you know, it was that was your hour of sort of going at it, and everything was out the window, and you weren't thinking about anything else. But so I would say, in a way, probably, you know, that buzz and stuff of championships different. You know, even playing with Antrim as well, you know, NASA league games are different to championship games regardless, you know, if
yeah.
It was the same sort of thing, you know, I'd say a couple of league games, you know, you were, mind was 10 miles down the road, you know, thinking about things, and whereas what was that championship, the sort of bigger the game or bigger the occasion, you know, the more sort of nearly focused you, like, it was strange way to do it, like, strange thing to explain too, like, and it's wrong too, like, you know, I should have really been telling people that, but.
Mm. Well, it's in the past. In the past is one of my.
I know.
We hear a lot about kind of stigma around mental health. This, like, I think the only time I ever hear the word stigma is mm-hmm. it's around mental health. Seems to be. And especially for men, and maybe for that reason, I didn't relish being open and talking about it, mm-hmm. And still don't really to an extent, mm-hmm. Or it doesn't come easily to me. But there are definitely times when I feel weak, mm-hmm. especially when I kind of try to be a telepathist and kind of think what other people are thinking of me.
Yeah.
Have you felt? What's the reaction been for you? Like, have you ever felt like that somebody has kind of been kind of looking down on you because mm-hmm. of what you've spoken about, or what's your experience?
No, it's been. I think from no age really, I've always been in the mindset where I genuinely don't care what other people think. You know, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it may be in. Surrounding mental health, you know, I don't care what someone thinks or what anyone says. You know, I didn't tell Mum or Maria that I was going to put it out there, and you know, I did tell them too, and you know, as long as all I was thinking was them two sort of got my back, and I didn't really care what, and yeah. To be honest, I didn't hear a bad word said. I'm sure there has been, but well, I like to think there hasn't been, but you never know. I haven't really got. No one said anything.
Even sometimes, my reaction has been similar to that mm-hmm. in terms of like it's been. I've felt and heard nothing but positive, mm-hmm. but positivity. I've received nothing but positivity.
Yeah.
I think if it does come up, it kind of will be unspoken or unsaid. Yeah. I think, and that isn't something that I've really experienced. Have you any kind of experience of that?
No, just you get people who wouldn't say anything, and then if they have a wee drink or two in them, then they go like, you know, glad you done that, and you know, I was feeling the same at a stage, and I think the biggest reaction was to me was a load of people were like, can't believe you would never have thought, do you know, and that's you could become an expert at hiding it.
Yeah.
And because I was so always in the middle of having a crack and probably loudest in changing rooms and in general and pretty outgoing, I think that's what probably the biggest sort of feedback I got was that couldn't believe it was, you know, of me, like, so.
Yeah,
I just thought that, you know, you don't know who's sitting beside you in the change room, what they're going through. It might not necessarily be grief. It could be gambling or alcohol or drugs or family problems or, you know.
Yeah.
Someone could turn around and go, well, the biggest slobber in our change room is able to say something about it or get help and do something about it, then why can't I? Like, and I suppose,
yeah,
you know, even coming across different people, like, you know, messages from all over the country, and I was mostly going, a load of people's reaction was, I felt like I wrote that myself, only with, you know, all the same sort of, and it just shows you how many people are going through it, and
going through it alone.
Everybody
going through, like, so many people going through almost exactly the same thing,
yeah,
and feeling for some reason that they are alone, yeah, when they're doing it.
Yeah, and as I say, it may not necessarily be grief or, you know, losing someone. As I say, it could be other, you know, it could be gambling or alcohol or drugs or family breakdowns, or it could be anything. It could be losing a job or breaking up with a girlfriend or this, that and the other. But, you know, everyone's different, and, you know, it's just not letting it get to a stage where they think they've nothing else, no other option, and like suicide seems to be the option. And
a little bit in the piece you wrote struck me as you said, kind of 3 years later, 3 years after you mm-hmm. had the initial kind of bout, and then you had a new bout, and you decided, yeah, like, you know, you were going to sort it once and for all now, and that you're kind of happy that you're in a position, the things you did, and you have mechanisms in place now to kind of let you to handle it and to deal mm-hmm. with it better.
Yeah.
What can you talk a little bit about what those mechanisms are? Is it something how do you recognise or what do you put in place?
I suppose it was just, it was nearly comparing, like, I was so, like, when during that stage, I was so, even playing, I was so highly strung. I suppose the best way I could do it was always relating to sport, like sport in the brain, but all I was comparing was the way I was playing then. You know, it was very much like very highly strung, you know, any wee small mistake, you know, taking lumps out of a goalpost, like nearly breaking my foot, kicking posts, just, and when I look back, I'm like, I remember just going like, what are you doing? Like, you know, I think it was more conversations with myself going like, what are you doing? And I think just, again, as I said, being rational about your, you know, your thinking is the big one. The CBT was a big help with that. And again, as I say, like, you know, one in comparison or in terms of sport, you know, 10 seconds of a sort of scenario of a mistake, you know, is not 10 seconds out of 60 minutes. You know, it's not a bad game, it's a bad 10 seconds. You know, it's how you recover, and I'm a lot calmer now. I suppose that comes with age too, an age thing.
Experience as well. As age.
I think, you know, different managers as well, if they're a sort of calming sort of way about them, and I suppose the people you have around you too, like, but I don't think it was like, I didn't, you know, I think it was more conversations nearly with myself, just as opposed to, you know, like a diagram or like a set way, but I just know now myself, you know, as I say, it probably comes with age and maturity a bit, and probably being a lot more at ease and comfortable with myself, because I think when you're in the sort of peak of all the, you know, of the main sort of bad time I was going through, you know, everything is in question, like, you know, you're insecure about everything, you know. It's probably at that stage where it was like going, you're very insecure even about playing and everything, I suppose, like, you know, as well, like, I was in and out of temporary sort of jobs at that time. I'd finished university and was always in and out temporary jobs, and you know, hearing the sob stories, you came second in that interview, but then I think doing that through the GPA as well, you know, they've people that can sort of help you with interviews and sort of all that side of, you know, career wise, and you know, I'd done all that too, and I think being just, you know, been a permanent job now for the last sort of 4 years or so, 3-4 years, and I suppose all that all adds up too, you know. Like the word secure, and then just being sort of sure of yourself too, is a big thing too.
Absolutely. And how do you, like, you spoke there about kind of the way you spoke to yourself, or the way the self talk you had when things went wrong. Yeah. How do you kind of speak to yourself now compared to what you were a few years ago?
A lot calmer, you know. Back then it was sort of like, you know, all sort of guts and thunder, like, you know, it was all like nearly like, you know, seen from Braveheart, William Wallace stuff, like, you know, it was all just, it was nearly borderline madness, like, you know, if I'd have been looking on and going, if I'd have been looking from the sideline on at me going, there's ways of eating grass, like, you know, you know, I'd have been going, you know, at any opportunity, it's never happened, and, you know, I've never even surprising. I think I've maybe got max 5 yellow cards in my life, but, like, if I'd have been looking on at me, I was like, this boy is gonna strike out at someone or, you know, do something mad, like, you know, it was nearly going, like, but now it's a lot calmer, I think, you know. Girlfriend Maria is a big helping influence too, you know, very calm and very rational being, and very patient, and, you know, listening to all the ups and downs of football and stuff, and her job's a social worker, she's a social worker too, like, so that nearly, we didn't meet that way either, like, but she's a very calming influence on me too, like, you know, so
So you feel grounded. Yeah. It seems like you feel that more grounded then.
Yeah, and again, go back to playing the football, like, it's probably the best thing I know is it shows, I think, now playing. Like, you know, if I was looking at all my different set of eyes, if you can see the goal, there's no meltdowns or panics or taking lumps out of posts or there's none of that, like.
No?
Not as much.
Maybe 90-10
now. Maybe it's a wee 10% sometimes if it's touched.
Just listening to you, you're talking about it's clear, like, you know, the your profile is around sport, and uh-huh. like that's that's a huge part of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the self talk that you're talking about, you're talking about it in the context of sport.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever kind of negative self talk kind of outside of sport as well? And how is that?
It's much more under control, I think. You know, a lot of sort of skills that you learn from sport, not physical skills of playing, but like they're all transferable.
Mm.
You know, even with working too. You know, with positive self talk and stuff before matches, and it's the same as if you think anything's going bad, just.
Do you practice that?
I don't. It's not something I would religiously do. It would be, if it sort of felt it coming on, I would do something about it. I just think I manage things a lot better. I think it's the big thing.
And
that always sticks out in my mind now as well. I think if you have one bad hour, it's not a bad day. It's a bad hour.
Mm.
I think that's important. With people where you go. You hear people, and I used to be a lot like, yesterday was a nightmare. But if you actually go, what happened? Stubbed my toe in the door or something. It's like, it's not a bad day. It's just being, and that's how I think with mental health and depression and anxiety, when they're hand in hand, is that, you think it's a bad day, and then you're like, oh, it's been a nightmare a week, and then you're like, shit life sort of thing,
and it's out of line.
But there is, and it just keeps going, and that's nearly what if you listen to people a lot more, I think, and go, you hear people going, I'm depressed, this is depressing, and you're like, is it? Because if you're ever at a stage where you can't get out of bed because of it, I think that's when it's, you'll have to know about it, like, in a sort of hostile way, but you would know all about it, thing, if you can't get out of bed.
So one of the pieces, I think it was a Declan Bogue piece, it might be an interview with you around May. And he was he mentioned in that, and I think you've mentioned already here, but the kind of the suicide rates, he had mentioned it, kind of like 30 to 34 North Belfast men are the highest suicide risk in
Europe.
He mentioned it's in Europe.
North and West Belfast have it's nearly sort of conjoined, is like the highest in Europe.
So this is your hint, effectively you're 31, 32 years old. You're a man, you live in West Belfast.
Yeah.
So you're right in that negative bullseye zone. What is, can you put your finger on kind of anything that kind of adds up to that?
It's, it could be a lot of things. It's, some of the areas are in West and North, social deprivation, jobs, opportunities for people. Conflict in those areas for 30-odd years has sort of been maybe a knock-on effect. There's a lot of people in both areas, a lot of groups are doing great work for, the communities and especially younger. Lot of younger men, getting them involved, getting them, if they're on sort of, a ropey enough path, with groups of people they're hanging out with or anything, that, they're getting them, teaching them skills earlier, putting them on courses where they can do something for themselves. So, it's just, you sort of hear it. I think it was the same as Dublin. I don't know if it's like a, maybe it's more because of major cities, but the rates are crazy, girls and females are talk a lot easier than men, and you know, even if it's going out for tea or coffee, you know, they probably get so much off their chest, and very few and far between is it females. You know, it just seems to be, as you say, between, you know, 30, 31 to 35 is the same main sort of crux of it, really.
What's the there's no easy answer to it, but like, what do you think could be done, or what do you think could, like you spoke about the motivation for writing the piece was like, this was very clearly in your, like, something you've been thinking about, that like, if you got something out there that people might kind of, like, if one person read it and kind of had a positive impact, it was worth doing. But like, have you anything else in mind for, like, you know, for a part for you to play in, kind of, in, or like, are you still kind of, like, what are your thoughts on kind of, like, things that can be done?
Yeah, well, it doesn't help that there's no government sitting in the north, which is making people who are on the sort of, you know, dealing with it on a daily basis, you know, charities and community groups who are, you know, passionate people about this, you know, foaming at the mouth, they get their hands stuck in. The big thing seems to be the mental health hubs that they're trying to do. They're trying to get those sort of up and running in the north here, definitely in Belfast anyway. I suppose the mental health first aid, I think, in workplaces too. You know, a lot of people you hear going off stress and, you know, nothing put in place. You know, we're, as again, quick to do, I'm a first aider in work.
Nice.
God love anyone that ever cuts their hand or anything that I have to go to them, but you know, we're quick enough. If somebody cuts a finger, you know, there's a whole, you know, hullabala around, you know, it's nearly like an episode of Casualty, where, like, people are, whereas, like, if someone's sitting there behind a screen 100 miles away, how are they meant to do their job properly? I think it's having things set up in workplaces, in somewhere, like, I don't know if it's in where people can go to without feeling like they're being judged, or, you know, you know, and that's the stigma that we talk about, is that he's going for counselling, or he's going to think I'm going for counselling. And, you know, a lot of people, especially if it's dealing with, you know, if there's alcohol or drugs involved, you know, the paranoia setting in, you know, I'm not going there, they'll see me going, and, you know, whereas, I don't know the actual out-and-out answer, but I'd love to be involved in trying to help and do something about it. Like,
It's interesting you say about the workplace, because there's so many factors. But work is, like, if you think of the things you spend most of your time doing, like, it's kind of like, it's in like a third of the day working and a third of the day sleeping. And if those two things aren't right, if you're not getting good sleep hygiene, and your workplace is not, like, and I think there's, like, for me, like, my own experience, I feel that there's more to be done both on the employee side and the employer side. So my, like, I wasn't honest enough when I was in jobs that were actually making me ill. There's no way, like, I just wasn't honest and open enough. But equally, there wasn't a framework or an avenue or a pathway for me to go down that I felt something could be addressed. So I definitely think on both sides of those, there's loads more to be done.
Even if it's a mental health officer in each work, where, you know, it doesn't have to be a counselor, where you can just go and speak to someone in workplace, that, you know, to get away from, you know, simple as emailing them, or I don't know. But I definitely think there's something there to be done. You know, I hear a lot of people in a lot of different workplaces. You know, often stress, and, you know, it's sitting behind computers or whatever they do on a daily basis, you know, stressed out and can't go into work over it.
And stress, like, stress is a synonym for so many things. Like, it covers all. It covers, you get stressed on a sick certificate. Like, that can be really anything. Like, anything's underneath there.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks back, I was at Health and Wellbeing Awards through, it was a charity in Belfast, in Inspire Wellbeing, and, you know, they're all these companies promoting good mental health in their workplace and for their employees, and good places to work. And, you know, it was really good to see, like, you know, it was really It was really positive. It was a really positive night, but it was really positive to see so many companies across. It's all for Belfast that are doing that. So,
No, it is. It's
good to see
moving in the right direction.
It is, even in terms of GAA as well. You know, most clubs have, you know, wellbeing officers, mental health wellbeing officers. That, you know, the GAA are doing their utmost with it. I think they're going in the right direction with it. But it's like anything. It's, you know, with the stigma with it again. You know, it's age profiles. You know, it's different generations where, you know, you probably have men in their 50s, 60s, give yourself a shake, or, you know, I think we're steadily starting to move away from that. I think in a way, you know, you hear a lot of negative things about social media. You know, people only put their highlight reels on. You know, it's all the good stuff. You know, but
it's a big factor, I think.
It has its pros and cons, I suppose. But I think even in terms of putting it out there and getting it sort of circulating, it's a really good way for that. You know, I think at any stage, whether everyone always has their phone on them now, you know, if it's sitting on a bus or a train going to and from work, or if it's in work, maybe just sneakily on social media or whatever, you know, people can come across different things, whether it's articles or blogs like that one I had done, and somebody's reading it and they're on their break and they're like, sounds like me, and to do something about it, then I think it's good that way. But I think there's no concrete answer for it. It's difficult.
No, social media is like the way I kind of like digital. My day to day is kind of like digital comms, digital marketing for right now. That's what it is. And the way I describe it is kind of like the best and the worst invention of all time. Like it's the amount of things that it makes possible that weren't possible 10 years ago is incredible.
Yeah.
But equally, like if you want to find if you're in the mindset of finding the thing if your mindset is going to see the negative and see the downside and stuff, that like that's just magnified by a million from social media.
Yeah, it is. But if you were concentrating on the pros of it in terms of mental health, it's good for, I think, putting it out there for people to go who aren't comfortable maybe yet about talking or going to get help. Maybe it'll be like, you know, it's in the back of their mind, even going, well, they've done it, or he's done it, or she's done it. So
I think it's
good in that sense.
And the GEA has obviously been GEA/GPA, well, obviously two very different organisations, but your place in the GEA has been good for you during this, has it?
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't know what I would do myself without it. Do you know, it's probably during that time it was it was difficult in terms of as I say, I mentioned earlier, it was nearly like times trainings and that was a chore, but then at the same time you like, what would I do about it? Like, you know, be able to go away, you know, even training and stuff, and putting your energy into something positive. And you know, I think the GAA in general, GAA community, like all over the country, are very good when it comes to things like that. So, I mean, it wasn't just based like Antrim people being in contact. It was all over Ulster, all over the country. Like, you know, so I think when they sort of just rally around people, I think in that, I suppose it's always good to see. And say the GPA were more than good to me. Like, very supportive, very, you know, if you ask the counselling, and you know, they were on the ball quick, like, you know, doing things. I think they're very, very good. Like,
when it comes to goalkeeping, you're not even at your peak yet, right?
Hopefully not. No.
and I'm not joking. It feels like, especially the way things are right now, it feels like, you know, like you could easily, like, you know, 35, 36 almost kind of feels like a peak for a goalkeeper in terms of the. Are you under pressure in Antrim? Is there a couple of lads biting at your heels?
There's a couple of young lads in. This year there was a couple of young boys in there. Very good as well, like, and the same as St Gall's. There's always been really good competition there at the club too, like. So it's just I waited for my chance for a long time, like. So I think when I'm in, I'm just gonna sort of be greedy and play as much as I can, and because it'll not last forever, like. And
do you think about what happens afterwards?
suppose sometimes, you know, sometimes you go, I can't be bothered with this anymore, or, you know, but I know fine rightly, like, if it wasn't there, I would struggle probably standing trying to watch, you know.
Would you see yourself still being involved at some level, or coaching, or
maybe, you know, quite interested in sort of the, you know, the strength and conditioning side of things. Right. I don't know if I go full into management. You know, it looks like a full time job. You know, especially at county level, I don't know how they do it. You know, it's, you know, if you're training 4 or 5 days a week, you would need full support from a county board and a good backroom staff there around you. Like, so it would just be, it would be constant. But I do like the sort of conditioning side of things and even goalkeeping side of things. Like,
It seems to be, it's kind of like a golden, it seems like a golden time for goalkeepers. The goalkeepers have never been more important than they are now. That's what it seems like.
It is. It's, I suppose, you know, obviously, he's probably the best GAA player ever, you know, in terms of Cluxton with Dublin, regardless of, well, you're a Meath man now, but he's revolutionised.
Most influential anyway.
Has. Like, he's changed the position where it's nearly, you know, even like the last 5, 6, 7 years, you know, how much the opposition concentrate on your kick out, you know, there's an increase in, what way we'll put it, verbal conversations from forwards, you know, when you're about to kick the ball. You know, I think it's the big thing is that if you can win your own sort of ball, then, you know, what can the other team do about it?
Has that become easily to you? Yeah, right, it was a bit in one of your pieces, I think, about the, but you woke up with the voice of Lenny.
Oh, that
Lenny.
Was Lenny. Lenny was, you know, well, Lenny is a St. Gall's club man, so Lenny was relentless on kickouts about retaining the ball, and he played for St. Gall's for a long time, played sevens, played basketball, so it's nearly like I sort of knew it was coming. No, I enjoy it. I do enjoy it. Like, you know, you're nearly, not that you're obsessed with, but you're nearly going, right, how many, 10 kickouts, many that we win? Do you know, it's at 8 attacks, it's nearly getting up, but it's nearly like you're a quarterback or a 10 in rugby, nearly now, like, so, so I say to myself, like, I'll just, Johnny Saxton or Tom Brady or something. No, I enjoy it, it's good.
Talk to me a bit, we haven't spoken about it today, so talk to me a little bit about your dad, obviously the relationship you had with him.
Well, he was born in West Belfast too. Started off as he was a coal man in his early days. When he was like maybe 15, 16, I think. And then he was a milkman for, you know, 20, 30 years maybe in West Belfast, Oliver Andersonstown, sort of Falls Road. So he wouldn't have been mad into sport. Mum is, though, on the other hand, probably makes up for two people. Mad into it, you know, whereas he would have been asking, you know, when you're sort of 18, 19, you come home and you get beaten at like a championship match, and what was the score? And you say it was like 110-109, and what'd you let the goal in for? And you're like, just asking these questions that only dads can do, like, and you know, other people you hear going, like, I didn't let, no, you're right, to lose the plot going. I didn't let it in on purpose, like, and then, or if we could beat the year after where we're all Ireland club champions, you know, it was the same sort of questions. You're like, no, not today, like, don't be asking today. But no, everyone knew him, like, from he'd done the milk, so a lot of even players from other clubs and stuff would have been their milkman and would have been he was a taxi man in West Belfast then, probably the last 10 years of in around the area, so everyone got, he knew everyone, and wouldn't have been much in the sport, but, you know, couldn't wait to tell him probably about, you know, myself playing and stuff. So he was a big smoker, I think. He was maybe thinking from 15-ish, 14, which was the sort of cool thing to do back then. And then he smoked. You know, he was a heavy smoker, like, it's probably, you know, between 20 and 40 a day. It was strange, like, from no age, I was always, like, mum would have said, from, you know, 4 or 5, I was forever breaking cigarettes, putting them in the bin. Not long after, and Mum was sort of not clearing the stuff out, but sort of going through all his clothes or whatever, and found a note in their cupboard that I wrote in crayon, and like when I was five or something, mm-hmm. saying, "Will you, Dad? Will you please?" Left it on his pillow and then ran into bed. That I wrote, "Dad, will you please stop smoking? I'm a scared of you, Dan." Mm. So this was at five. Mm. So when I had seen the smoking, don't know how I picked it up, but it was just forever like breaking them, mm. putting them down the back of radiators. And then there you go. Like it turned out it was terminal lung. Mm. I suppose it was terminal lung, and then they sort of say that the city hospital here, the cancer centre, are unbelievable. Like the way they sort of, well, they know their stuff inside out, obviously, too, and how tentative they are, too. They were class. Like, so they sort of said it could be 9 months or it could be 3 years, depending on the person, and it was, like, 8 months and three quarters, like, so they weren't far wrong. But I think it sort of just came back then. It was in his lymph nodes, so I think once it's there, it can travel the major organs, and came back, and it was in the brain and kidney and everywhere. And then I think there's something to be said about chemotherapy too. I think the third sort of dose of chemotherapy, the first two times, he'd done it twice, sort of between July and December, and it was fine. He was bald headed anyway, so it wasn't like it was severe hair loss or anything. It was like eyebrows or something, so it didn't look, you know, when you see someone that would have had a load of hair and they lost their hair, it nearly makes them look sicker than what they are, I think. But he didn't really look like that. But the third dose of chemo, sort of in January time, I think, sort of didn't agree with him, and it made him very ill. And then he was in hospital for a week, and then it's the end of February that he had passed away then, that 2013. But it was all quick enough then, once he went in the hospital.
And do you still keep him with you? Like, you know, do you still feel his presence?
I do, yeah. It was so weird. Say Milltown Cemetery is next to St. Gall's, and the day after it sort of passed away, me and Mum went down to the cemetery and sort of said there's new sort of plot up at the front here beside the main road. It was like sort of people drinking graveyards. Well, people drinking graveyards are nuts anyway. Like, I mean, I wouldn't be getting in there at night anyway to get spooked out. But I said there's a part down the bottom, and it's quieter sort of thing. It's closer to the sort of motorway, but it's actually in line nearly with the top goalpost at St. Gall's Pits. So I think it's always like, we always warm up in a specific corner, and it's over at that corner. We always have sort of done that. And anytime, sort of just know it's there. Like, and
he's in your eye line.
He's there, and probably asking stupid questions and doing my head, I think. But sure, that's what dads are designed to do. Like, you know, you go into different houses, mates' houses, or you hear them with their dads, and they're like, "He's doing my head," and like, you know, only the way dads can. Like, but no, I'm sure he's happy enough, I think.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Once he can see you from where he is, he can kind of slag you off for any of the mistakes.
I know. Well, that's it. I'd say he's probably going, well, he's a lot calmer now, like, so it's good.
It's been great talking to you, Chris. What excites you most right now?
Enjoying playing football and stuff, you know, with St. Gall's, future ahead with Maria. That excites, you know, it's exciting as well, and just looking forward to what lies ahead.